Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, as wildfires continue to ravage the West Coast, is climate change posing an increasing fire threat to our area, in particular the Pine Barrens? Also, we're getting into peak migration season for birds. Keith Russell of Audubon, Pennsylvania, will tell us why many migrate at night and how to best experience this natural wonder. But we begin with the likelihood that New Jersey will soon have a millionaire's tax in place. Governor Murphy has been pushing the idea since he first took office, but lacked the support of the Democrat-led legislature, which twice rejected it. However, COVID-19 has upended the landscape, and legislative leaders are now on board with the proposal also including a tax rebate of as much as $500 for many middle-class and poor families. As of July, the unemployment rate was just under 14%. And paraphrasing here, the governor's calling on the wealthy to share in the sacrifice. Perhaps not surprisingly, Republican legislators have a different view, one lawmaker calling the millionaire's tax an election year stunt. We've got a lot to unpack with this story, and WHYY's Joe Hernandez is here to help us do that. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Mary.
First, let's talk about how much the income tax would rise for people making over $1 million a year and how much this might raise for the state annually, Joe.
Yeah, so this would increase the tax rate on income between $1 million and $5 million. It would go from 8.97% to 10.75%. Right now, any income you make over $5 million is taxed at the higher rate, 10.75%. But this would change that to make any income over $1 million taxed at the 10.75% bracket. And the state says that could bring in $390 million in the fiscal year.
I had a sizable hike. So the pandemic split New Jersey's budget process. As I understand it, the state is now operating under a temporary budget right now and a deadline for the second spending plan, which will run through the rest of the fiscal year. That's, I think, the 30th of this month. There is a gap of approximately $5 billion to contend with in budget plan number two. How much does a millionaire's tax do to fill this, Joe?
Yeah, so the budget gap being $5 billion, the millionaire's tax would bring in about $390 million. But as I'm sure we'll talk about, the governor has some ideas for how to use that money. The millionaire's tax increase wouldn't really affect the budget gap because the governor wants to use the money for something else. But there's other ways that Murphy wants to chip away at that budget gap, and that's a major borrowing initiative of $4 billion, raising other taxes, and then doing some cuts to state spending.
Okay. So let's get to the rebate that is in this proposal for many middle and low-income families. That would be a great chunk of this millionaire's tax would go to that, correct?
That's right. So this is a rebate. It would be of up to $500. Some people could get a little less depending on how you qualify. But it would go to households with children. So a two-parent household with incomes below $150,000 or a single-parent household with an annual income below $75,000 would be eligible for this tax rebate. And they would have to have children in those households. And the Murphy administration says this could impact 800,000 New Jersey households. New Jersey, obviously, anyone who's ever lived there, passed through, knows that it's known for its notoriously high property taxes.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a pitch to those people who've been saying for years, what are you going to do about my property taxes? Murphy is now saying, we're asking the wealthiest New Jerseyans to chip in a little more, and we're going to use that money to cut down on your property taxes.
So if this proposal does receive final legislative approval, does the rebate remain in place indefinitely?
No, it would only remain in place as long as it's in the budget, which would be 1 year. But Murphy has said that he would like to see it remain in place indefinitely. Whether that would actually occur or not would still be, you know, it's still unclear since this budget is just for the 9 month shortened fiscal year that's upcoming.
Okay. State Senate President Steve Sweeney has in the past opposed a millionaire's tax. What is he saying now about his change of heart?
Yeah, well, Sweeney and other Democrats in the legislature, when Governor Christie, the Republican, was governor, wanted a millionaire's tax. They pushed for it, and Christie was against it. But then when Murphy took office and he wanted to raise taxes on millionaires, he, himself, a former Goldman Sachs executive, is a millionaire. he pushed for it, and the Democrats in the legislature said no. They said basically taxes are too high. We need to remain competitive. Some people saw this as a kind of political spat between Sweeney, a South Jersey guy, and Murphy, a North Jersey guy. Now Sweeney says the pandemic has hit. Families are clearly hurting. Lower income, middle-income people hurting especially because of the pandemic. Now is the time to do the millionaire's tax. The people who are faring well can chip in a little more and help those families who are hurting because of coronavirus.
And with Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin also on board, does this all but assure passage of a millionaire's tax in New Jersey?
It does seem that way. I mean, Democrats control both houses of the legislature and, often take their cues from leadership in those houses. So we still have yet to, the budget hasn't gone before budget committees yet or up for a full vote, but it does seem likely that it will pass.
Yeah, well, time is moving quickly, too. Again, the deadline's the 30th, correct?
The deadline is the 30th, yes, because of a confusing thing New Jersey did this year in kind of splitting up its fiscal year to deal with the pandemic. But hearings are going to start this week, and both houses have full session scheduled for this week and next week. So we could get a vote on the budget as quickly as this week.
Okay. Republican leaders are pushing back on the millionaire's tax. What are they saying, Joe?
They're saying it would make New Jersey less competitive and that millionaires will see this tax hike and move to a state like Florida or, somewhere else where the taxes are lower for them. They often argue this point when Murphy talks about raising taxes on millionaires, that it will make New Jersey less competitive with other states when it comes to attracting high-income earners. New Jersey has a lot of them because of its proximity to New York City. And so they're arguing basically, as Assemblyman John Bramnick said, I think that this is going to be a gift to Florida and that people will flee the state. Now, there's no kind of evidence in mass that this is going to happen, but that is their prediction. And they say that this will make things worse for New Jersey.
Okay. There are other tax increase proposals in this budget plan. What are they, Joe?
Yeah, well, there's the remember, Murphy proposed a budget much earlier this year before the pandemic hit, which had some of these tax increases in it. And then the pandemic kind of threw everything up into chaos and he had to propose a new budget. That new budget took some of those old ideas and brought them back. And that includes a tax hike on cigarettes, increases in gun fees, and a corporate business tax surcharge, basically a little bit more for companies to pay that was supposed to be temporary, but this budget would make that permanent.
Governor Murphy had wanted to tax financial transactions, but there was some very quick reaction from entities such as the New York Stock Exchange. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the stock exchanges, while they're based in New York and they have their physical trading floors there, many of them have these big data centers in New Jersey where the transactions are computerized and actually done. And a proposal in New Jersey that's floating around and still floating around would tax financial transactions, those kind of computer transactions that happen across the wires in New Jersey. Murphy still supports this. Some Democrats in the legislature support it. But when the stock exchanges heard about this, at least one of them said that they were thinking about leaving New Jersey because of it and going to some backup servers in Chicago, I think. Murphy has not what's called scored this for the budget, meaning they're not counting on this revenue in the budget.
Okay.
But they are still, I think lawmakers are still going to go ahead with this proposal, and it's still possible that it would happen. And Murphy makes the same argument here that he makes with the millionaire's tax, which is that financial transactions, people on Wall Street who are doing these big financial transactions can afford to pay a little bit more to help the lower income people who are hurting right now.
Let's get back to something you referenced a little bit earlier. Again, the projected budget gap is $5 billion. Governor Murphy is hoping tax increases will bring in about $1 billion. The other $4 billion would be borrowed, and Governor Murphy can do this under a law he signed this summer, which Republicans then sued against. Give us a refresher on this.
So this is a law passed by the Democratic legislature that Murphy asked for, and they passed and he signed. And it would allow him to borrow up to $9.9 billion during an emergency such as the state is in right now. without voter approval, excuse me. And typically when you're borrowing this quantity of money, $4 billion, I mean, that's just it's a huge amount for the state to borrow, because ultimately taxpayers are on the hook to pay it back. You put that on the ballot and voters approve it or not. You say, I want to borrow this amount of money for this purpose. But in this case, the administration is using this law to say, we're in an emergency. We're seeing our tax revenues plummet. People are out of jobs, and we need to borrow this amount of money to dig out of this hole that we're in because of the pandemic. So Republicans sued to stop the plan. They got it up to the state Supreme Court pretty quickly. The Supreme Court expedited it. And ultimately, the Supreme Court allowed the law to stand up and said the administration can borrow for items, you know, related to the pandemic. They might not be able to borrow to build a new sports stadium, but they can borrow for items that will help the state recover from the pandemic. And they're only allowed to borrow as much as there is a deficit. So if the Treasury said, okay, we're going to be out $4 billion, that's how much we need. And in 3 months, they said, actually, we're going to be out $2 billion, then they would have to borrow $2 billion. But the state is allowed now to borrow this high amount of money without voter approval.
Okay, so there's borrowing, there are tax increases, and also Governor Murphy has proposed some sizable budget cuts. I think it's over $1 billion worth. Joe, what's notable that's on the chopping block?
Well, one of the big ones that we've heard a lot about, which was first reported in Politico, was cuts to a program that provided mental health and other services for students in schools. And there was a lot of pushback from teachers, from even lawmakers, and they basically said students, you know, if ever they needed mental health services in schools, it's right now. Many of them are disconnected, affected by the pandemic, things like that. And Murphy later said, you know, he recognized this was something that a lot of people supported, and they would try to find a way to bring it back in. But other cuts, you know, range from more substantial things to smaller things. A lot of the cuts would be kind of substituted with federal funding. There were cuts to some reentry programs, and it kind of was across the board. Murphy said he asked all of his department secretaries to come back to him with plans for what they call efficiencies to the budget.
All right. And also quickly, Joe, outside the budget, the gas tax in New Jersey is going up soon, and it's a pretty sizable hike.
Yeah, the gas tax will go up. This is something that people were hoping wouldn't happen. I think even maybe Murphy himself doesn't necessarily want, but says that he's legally required to do, and that's because of a law agreed to between the legislature and former Governor Chris Christie to fund the Transportation Trust Fund, which is a big pot of money that is used to pay for transportation infrastructure upgrades, projects, things like that. It's funded through the gas tax, and so the gas tax, if revenues are lower if gas tax revenues are lower, meaning fewer people are filling up at the pump.
Joe, I got to stop you there. Joe Hernandez, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us.
Thanks,
stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Horrific wildfires on the West Coast dominated the news for weeks, and coverage likely will continue as fire season persists for several more months. Environmental experts say the nightmare scenario in California, Oregon, and Washington state has been intensified by climate change. And while the East Coast is different than the West geographically, we were wondering if global warming is presenting an increased fire risk here in New Jersey's heavily forested Pine Barrens. Steve Maurer is Assistant Chief of the New Jersey Forest Fire Service, and he joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Hello, Steve.
Good morning, Mary.
Let's start by talking about the Pine Barrens, how the vegetation in forested areas there is structured, and what might make a situation ripe for fire.
Well, obviously, the Pine Barrens are New Jersey's last holdout with the pines of New Jersey, and it's approximately 1 million acres in size in the heart of the most densely populated state in the Union. So it does pose both a unique challenge to protect as well as a unique challenge ecologically to preserve. So What we always are concerned about with in New Jersey from the forest fire perspective is, you know, what is the danger on any given day or period of time during the course of a year. As far as climate, I can't get into that because I don't know that anybody really knows for sure how it's affecting how the Pine Barrens of New Jersey are being impacted or not. There's both sides of the aisle, of course, and it's probably somewhere in between. As far as fire danger in New Jersey, our normal busy time of the year is the spring, which kind of throws some people for a loop when we say that. It's not normally the summertime unless we're in a drought period. So we are most concerned with the period of mid-March to about mid-May because that's when the sun is the strongest and normally the winds are blowing and the air is dry and the vegetation just hasn't leafed out from the long winter period. So that's what usually brings our highest fire danger and most of the time our largest wildfires here in New Jersey. Generally, once leaves come out on the hardwoods and the pine trees have started their spring flush of new needles, things temper a lot to the point where during the summer we get a lot of – normally we get rains during the summertime, and that usually keeps the fire danger low. As contrasted with the way things are in the West, where in the summertime the rains usually shut off, and then the fire activity picks up, and then they have the total wild card, which started a lot of the fires that we're hearing about now with thunderstorms that come through without any rain. Yeah. They're called dry lightning storms, and starting hundreds if not thousands of fires as they pass through. So.
Stephen, so I guess we've had some pretty big wildfires, of course, in the Pine Barrens. So does the potential exist for a catastrophic fire to happen at some point in New Jersey?
We can't always gauge things by size because of the fact that New Jersey is so densely populated. The potential exists that a small fire, you know, 5, 10, 50 acres, can do more damage than a fire that's 10 or 20,000 acres, just based on location. The proximity to housing developments or individual homes is going to dictate the severity to improve property and the final measure.
So in your years with the Forest Fire Service, have you seen changes in climate and how it might have affected the dryness, the risk for fire, the length of the fire season?
It seems to be changing in that we're not getting the really cold winters that we used to. Spring seems to come a few days or maybe a week or so earlier. Leaves are coming out on trees maybe a little bit sooner than they used to. Is it like I'm not a global expert. Is it related to that? It could be. I don't know. But there is changes. Obviously, the trees are getting bigger. Vegetation doesn't stay static, so it's going to continue to grow. And as these trees continue to grow, they, you know, become a little bit more of a hazard because they are able to loft the firebrands into the air that much easier because they're already taller. So there's more vegetation out there. When we get into the summertime, with the way that it's warming up, things have a tendency to dry out now more often. And it's just minor things that, you know, when you start looking at them all together, maybe they do have an impact on what's going on.
Okay. Well, what sort of precipitation would you want to see happen, say, over this winter to be protective as we head into the fire season in the spring?
Well, the best thing that we could see is that we have snow cover, because what that does, not necessarily, it adds obviously moisture to the ground, but anywhere that the snow falls, it will compact the needles and the leaves that are on the ground. And when it does that, it keeps the air out of the fuel that's on the ground. And by doing that, it makes it harder for the fire to spread when one does get started. If not, then it's all nice and fluffy, just like anybody that's ever made a campfire, you don't pack everything down into the campfire and try to start it. You want stuff that's all nice and fluffy. And by the fact that the lack of snow cover that we've been experiencing in New Jersey, those fuels that are on the ground might be damp, but they dry out quicker because they're not compacted.
Got it.
With snow, it'll compact it.
Stephen Maurer is Assistant Chief of the New Jersey Forest Fire Service, and he's joining us for the next few minutes on the regional roundup. You referenced, folks who are perhaps around the campfire out in the forested areas. At least one massive wildfire in California, Stephen, as most of us know, is started by a pyrotechnic device during a gender reveal party. So, you know, when conditions are right, it doesn't take much. What do you want people who might be camping, lighting a bonfire, that sort of thing, to be aware of?
We work very closely with all the campgrounds in the state of New Jersey, whether they're state, local, or privately owned, to keep them very aware of the fire conditions. And we advise them what they should be doing as far as notifying their campers, enforcing regulations as far as whether campfires can be on the ground, do they have to be elevated, or in some cases, and it's happened in years past, it hasn't happened recently, but in years past, we've actually banned campfires for dry spells, especially during the summer when a lot of people are out camping in the woods. It doesn't go over well, but for those that understand why we're doing that, they accept it and say, okay, well, we're trying to prevent some sort of calamity from occurring because of recklessness. A fire escaping into the woods after the camper has left or carelessly discarding the hot material into the woods have and probably will continue to start fires unintentionally by the people that just thought that they were trying to clean up their campsite.
Is some fire, Stephen, a natural part of life in the Pine Barrens and even beneficial?
It's beneficial. It certainly is. The timing is a whole other matter, as I was talking about earlier. A lot of times our thunderstorms in this part of the country, not just New Jersey, come through with moisture. And then when there's lightning, most of the time either the ground is already too wet or it's raining hard enough that anything that is struck by lightning has a tendency to be put out. We are noticing and have noticed over the last 5 to 10 years an increase, minor, but an increase in the number of fires that have been started by lightning, striking a tree or a couple trees, and then spreading out further once the rain has passed and the woods dry out again. It used to be an extremely minor component, essentially a dozen or so. Now we're looking at maybe a couple dozen to maybe 3 dozen fires a year that are started by lightning. A lot of times they don't go beyond the tree, a single tree or a couple trees. Once in a while, one will get bigger, but they don't normally get to the massive scale that we see of the fires that have been occurring in the West.
Let's talk about prevention. I remember years ago, I was, riding down, maybe it was Route 72 on my way to the shore, and I saw some fire along the side of the road, and I was a little concerned about that. And then somebody said, well, no, I think that's prescribed burning. So how does this work as a preemptive strike against wildfire?
Prescribed burning we usually try to do in the winter months, generally from January through the middle of March when our historic spring wildfire season begins, which, as I mentioned earlier, that's changing also. But what happens is that we will intentionally go out and try to remove the underbrush, the growth of small bushes, those needles and leaves from the previous year that have fallen, and make it harder for a fire that would begin along the edge of a road to initiate there from passing motorists or passing vehicles that have mechanical problems or anybody that carelessly discards any lighted material out of their window as they're passing by. It can also be beneficial in that it helps us essentially make the road wider by creating more unburnable material that the fire then has to stop at and hopefully does not jump in the case of what you were talking about, Route 72, which is a major east-west road that connects the middle of the state to the shore.
Well, and so what happens when a prescribed burn does take a bad turn? As I guess it can happen, right?
It can happen. However, what we always attempt to do is we wait for the proper weather conditions. We look at weather forecasts, and we have sufficient resources on hand, both personnel and equipment necessary to control a fire that before it would get out of hand. Can it happen? Oh, yes. You know, you let the genie out of the bottle, as we call the fire, and then you just have to sit back and do your best to manage what's going on and understand that at any given moment, the wind can shift and blow an ember across your control line and go burn someplace that you did not intend to. But that's the purpose of having all the extra resources on hand, is to take care of those, shall we say, oopses when they occur before something really bad happens.
Switching gears here for just a moment, Stephen. Some of New Jersey firefighters have gone to help with the situation out west. Is that correct?
That is very correct, yes.
Do you worry about them?
All the time, both when they're traveling out because of all the COVID concerns, as well as when they're actually on the fire.
What draws people to this type of work?
Oh, gosh. Any number of different things. A need to feel that they're serving the public, the adventure. Ask any first responder, and you'll probably get just as many answers.
So let's get to, I guess, a collaborative between New Jersey and some other states, in which the states share expertise through something called the New Jersey Prescribed Fire Learning Exchange. What are some of the other states participating, and what can we also take from this exchange in terms of prevention?
Well, the other states that I believe that are participating are pretty much all those here within the Mid-Atlantic region, Pennsylvania, Maryland, I think New York. I'm not sure of all the members that are part of that collaborative, but it's an opportunity to exchange information, look at different techniques for doing controlled burning. A lot of agencies, both at the state and federal level, look to New Jersey for ideas and opinions on what works, what doesn't work, because of the fact that we have such a long history of doing controlled burning within New Jersey.
Is the budget there to do the preventive work that needs to be done?
Really, I don't know as far as the actual budget numbers. That's beyond my bailiwick as far as what I have the information to provide. But we do our best with the money that we've been allotted and prioritize our operations accordingly.
So I guess another way to ask the question is, do you feel you have enough in the way of funding to do what you want to do to take preventive measures?
We do the best with what we've been allocated and prioritize our operations accordingly. Much more than that, everybody operates within a budget. And when it's an emergency, it's an emergency. We will do what we have to. And then from there on, if things have to be set aside for a later date, we'll set them aside for a later date if they can be. But emergency operations will always continue.
Fair enough. So, Stephen, what is the worst Pinelands fire you've seen in your time with the New Jersey's Forest Fire Service?
Oh, gosh. The one that I felt that had the most potential impact, if ultimately it did not, due to a number of circumstances, was back in 1995. It was called the Greenwood Fire, and it started in the Greenwood Forest Wildlife Management Area, and the wind was driving it strongly from the southwest to the northeast, and it was heading toward the retirement communities of Whiting. And fortunately, just about the time it was going to slam into the back of the development, the wind shifted out of the northwest and then essentially put it into a 90-degree turn away from the communities and into an old prescribed burn that had occurred, as well as an old wildfire, which essentially stopped it.
So a little bit more about the communities. Is what sort of preventive work needs to be done? Apparently the prescribed burn helped here. What else needs to be done to prevent communities from being harmed by wildfire in the Pine Barrens?
Ultimately, what they need to do is make sure they have sufficient clearance around the perimeter of the developments, where it's a clustered-type development, or if it's a single home, they need to make sure they have that same clearance. And we're looking at, 100 feet of clearance between the structures and the wood line, so that, first of all, we have enough room to operate as firefighters, and then second of all, that when the trees do burn and at some point the fire is going to come in the wrong direction and it's going to burn those trees, that it isn't hot enough to ignite the structures.
Is there a lot of work to be done, do you feel, to keep communities safe as things seem to be changing in the forest, as the climate does get warmer, according to the scientists, in order to protect these communities that are located right there in the middle of it?
We will probably never run out of work to do. So long story short, yes, we have a lot to do. We have to work with the communities to make that happen. We don't necessarily have the wherewithal and do it, to go in and do it for them. They have to be aware of the situation that they exist in, and some of these changes they're going to have to affect, so that they come in and try to preserve these developments and or the single homes that are out in the middle of the woods. Now, I understand people like to live in the trees. It looks nice, and probably 11 and a half months out of the year, it's fine. But for that couple of weeks when things are dry and windy, it could be a nightmare when a fire comes through and potentially impacts their home or their entire development.
All right, a sobering reminder, one that's much needed. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary.
All right, Stephen Maurer is Assistant Chief of the New Jersey Forest Fire Service. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we'll talk with Keith Russell with Audubon, Pennsylvania, about the night migration of birds. We're in the thick of it right now here in the Delaware Valley, how birds navigate, some of the obstacles cities present, and much more. And we'll take your calls and comments as well. So stick around. You are listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Huge flocks of birds are now migrating deep into the night when much of the Delaware Valley is presumably asleep. Many of those birds, songbirds and shorebirds. It's estimated that nationwide, hundreds of millions of birds have been heading to warmer locations. And some nights recently, tens of thousands have flown over the Delaware Valley by the light of the moon or stars, or by using magnetic fields. The dark of night doesn't lead to ideal bird watching conditions, of course, but there are ways to witness this natural phenomenon and to help keep birds safe, because as we'll hear, it can be a dangerous journey. Lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guest is Keith Russell, Urban Conservation Program Manager for Audubon, Pennsylvania. Good to have you with us, Keith.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you, Mary.
So many of the birds which we see during the day actually migrate at night. Why do they do this?
Well, there are so many birds migrating. We have, billions of birds with a B in North America and all over the globe. And if they were all going to migrate during the daytime, predators would be lined up waiting to pick them off. So it's safer to migrate at night. And they also are designed to migrate at night because they use the pattern of the stars as one of the cues often to migrate. So those are two reasons why they migrate at night, but there are actually many species of birds that migrate during the daytime only, and there are species of birds that migrate during the daytime and at night. But the vast majority of birds migrate mainly at night.
Give us a sense of how many birds are migrating over Pennsylvania at this point in time.
Well, here in Philadelphia, for example, Audubon did a study using a short-term not short-term, but short-range radar unit. And this was done in 2012. We placed this radar unit at the East Park Reservoir in North Philadelphia, which is the current site of the Discovery Center. So it's a nature center that we run there with the Outward Bound organization. And that radar unit was designed to measure all of the birds that flew within 1 kilometer of that unit. So at night, it would pick up birds that were migrating. And during the 2 weeks that the radar unit was there, we counted 735,000 individual birds passing within a kilometer of that radar unit.
That's incredible.
So that's just 1 kilometer in Philadelphia during the last 2 weeks of September. And we know from other evidence that that was not the peak time of migration that year. It occurred the next week during the first week of October. So you can do extrapolations, and, you know, you can certainly see that the number of birds that pass through the city is really gigantic. We can get counts on the number of birds best by using evidence from radar. And we used a short-range radar unit, but most of the work that's done to determine the number of birds that are migrating is using weather radar. And weather radar has gotten to the point where, or for many years, we've been able to separate out images of birds and distinguish them from water, rain, snow, or weather formations. So we can even sort of distinguish insects from birds. So it's very sophisticated science that's used to separate out these birds. But that gives us a very good idea of the volume of migration that's occurring in Pennsylvania and other places.
So, Keith Russell, you know, it's obviously much harder to see birds who are migrating at night. What's the best way to experience this?
Well, you know, one of the things that we can do is we can hear birds, and while they're migrating, they often do call. They're often low enough to be able to hear as they're flying by. So there are people who actually put up microphones, and they record the sounds that they hear, and once you get these recordings and play them back, you can identify many of the species based on unique sounds that they make while they're flying. That's pretty advanced stuff, but even if you don't understand the differences between the sounds that these birds make, if you're just standing outside at night on a cool, clear night, which is when birds tend to migrate the most, you can often hear them. And it's pretty interesting experience. Besides that, one of the most, I think, unique things I've ever experienced with in terms of night migration is going up to the Empire State Building and going up to their observation deck at the top of the building, which stays open and past midnight. Mm-hmm. And you can actually see the birds migrating because of the lights of the building. There they are flying past the building. And you can actually witness, you know, what's going on. And it's fascinating to see what they do. As they see the building coming up, they often struggle in the wind to fly in a way that will prevent them from slamming into the building. So they clearly see these buildings, and they're navigating around them as they go through the city. Well, but there are many dangers in the city for these birds. Lights are one. Glass is another one. Cats. Non-native plants, there's other issues that they deal with as well.
So some of the lights in the city are on, you know, in buildings, office buildings, pretty much all night. Are street lamps and house lights, say, in outlying suburban areas, are they as harmful?
Well, all lights can be harmful to birds and other types of wildlife. And because of the birds migrating at night, they often are allowed to see windows that they wouldn't see otherwise at night. So if you have street lamps on, or you have lights, you know, in your yard or other outdoor lighting, it may illuminate a window or other type of a glass surface. And if a bird can see that, there may be a reflection of something in there, and the birds think that that's just, you know, not a reflection, but that's real, and it goes flying into it. So lights are pretty harmful to birds at night, particularly because they illuminate glass. And, of course, if you're have a light on inside of a building, and you're illuminating the interior of a building. If a bird sees that from the outside, often they're very curious about buildings, and they will go into buildings. I mean, here in Philadelphia, birds go into the subway. They go into the Home Depot. They will enter all kinds of abandoned buildings out in the woods. They are not really deterred by these structures. I think that they appropriate them in ways that are appropriate to them, even though they're novel. You know, if we were perhaps dropped onto the surface of Mars, we would not know anything about that surface, but we would appropriate what we find in ways that are appropriate to our, you know, needs. And these birds use, you know, buildings and other man-made structures in similar ways, in all kinds of ingenious ways. So,
what is being done to mitigate the danger of artificial light at night and also glass? I know we lose an enormous number of birds every year to these dangers.
Yeah, the glass and the lights work together. Lights can certainly cause tremendous problems for birds all by themselves, and glass can do the same, but they often work together, especially at night. But one of the basic things that we can do about lights is to simply design lights so that they don't spill up into the sky where they're easily seen by birds that are migrating, but have lights shielded or only facing downwards. And we can also turn off lights as much as we possibly can. I know that that poses some real problems for people because we need to have lights on in many areas to keep us safe.
Sure.
But there are many issues that, you know, birds face because of lights. So I think in many cases there's compromises that can be made. Lights can be put on timers so that they're only going to be activated inside a building or maybe outside when someone's passing by or there's a need for them. So overall, we need to look at how much light we need and only use the amount that we need and not have lights on more than we need. And in terms of glass, basically, glass is everywhere, and it's increasing, and birds are exposed to it all the time. So the main thing that we can do about glass right now is to put patterns on the glass. If we can put dense patterns of dots or stripes or other patterns on the outside surface of windows or other glass surfaces, this presents the bird a challenge because they say, I can't fly through all that.
Got it.
They see that pattern, and it may just be, you know, patterns, but to them it's something real, something physical, and they avoid the glass. There is also an effort to design patterns that birds can see in the ultraviolet spectrum because they can see ultraviolet light, and that would be something that birds could see, but that people would not be able to see.
Okay.
And there's been much progress in that area. It's not perfected yet, but one day hopefully we'll be able to have patterns that warn birds that there's glass there, but we're not going to be bothered by them ourselves.
We are speaking with Keith Russell, Urban Conservation Program Manager for Audubon, Pennsylvania. Got some questions coming in. Bernie asks, does the brightly lit obelisk atop the new Comcast building pose a life-threatening risk to migrating birds who use the light from celestial objects for navigation?
It's the tallest building now in the city, and it's very bright. I know someone who lives in South portion of Center City, almost South Philadelphia, down on Fitzwater Street. He says that sometimes it's hard for him to sleep because the light from that tower is shining in his bedroom. So it's huge, and it can be seen from, you know, a long way off. We don't know for sure how birds are responding to that. We have some evidence that birds that see really bright lights at night in Philadelphia are distracted by those lights. But we don't have any direct evidence right now about how that light may be affecting birds that are migrating. In bad weather, when we have a lot of low clouds and rain, I think that that could probably be a bigger problem because they will fly around lights often when they're disoriented by having low clouds, and that could be a real problem then.
Question from Chris in East Hampton. What, if any, rollbacks of environmental regulations
have had an impact on bird migration?
That's an interesting question, and I think that there are definitely things that are that the current administration has tried and is trying, and a lot of these things are being fought in the courts. So it's fairly new. Anything that has happened in the last couple of years, I don't know that we have all the evidence in yet to say that that has caused problems for birds. But there's a lot of areas where there could be problems. So I don't want to go into all the details, but I think that's happened so recently, I would hesitate to sit and say it has definitely caused this or definitely caused that.
How is global warming impacting local bird populations?
Well, that's another thing that's sort of a slow-burning fire. And we have predictions that it will affect birds over the next, 20, 40, 60 years. And we certainly see in the short term, for example, here in Philadelphia, that there are some species that we didn't used to see in the winter that now we're seeing in the winter or seeing in larger numbers in the winter. So that sort of suggests that they're now spending the winter further north than they might have in previous years. And we can also see that during migration in the fall, there are birds that are migrating perhaps a little longer in the fall, or they're coming in a little earlier in the spring. So those are some of the things that may be climate-related that we can definitely say are changes that are being observed in recent years.
Are we losing bird populations, bird species?
We are. There was a major study that was done that was released last year that told us that we have about three in four birds that we had in 1970, so about 25% of the birds that were here, that's about 2.9 billion birds are gone. And that's a lot of birds.
Yeah, that's awful.
Yeah, and it's concentrated among, certain families. It's not across the board. We've actually gained in terms of the number of raptors, and that's a good thing because a lot of raptors like the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon were, on the endangered species list, and they have recovered. So we have done great things to help certain birds, but there's problems with other birds. And a lot of these are warblers and sparrows and other types of songbirds that have declined really significantly.
Keith, does it help migrating birds to set up feeders?
Well, feeders are designed to provide food for birds, and they do the best help for birds during the colder months when, you have severe weather. You don't need to feed birds during the summertime at all, except maybe hummingbirds. So it's best to just feed birds really in the Philadelphia area from November through maybe March, and make sure that you keep your bird feeder clean. Most of the birds that migrate through Philadelphia that would use bird feeders are going to be sparrows and finches because they eat seeds. But a lot of the other birds that migrate through Philadelphia are songbirds that eat insects, and they're not going to find them at bird feeders.
And worth mentioning, too, before we head out, there's a really cool online tool called Birdcast. If you go to that site, you can kind of get an approximate forecast of the migration intensity for your neck of the woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, lots of fun.
Good site.
Keith Russell, it has been so much fun meeting you over the airwaves. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Keith Russell is Urban Conservation Program Manager for Audubon, Pennsylvania. And don't forget to connect with us on social media. We are at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez, our producer, John Ahrens, with help today from Debbie Builder. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for joining us. Be well.